At the United Nations this week, world leaders have been delivering blunt words on the urgent need to tackle climate change.
If we don't lower our emissions, we're croaked. Absolutely croaked.
Also ahead, how Ukrainians living in frontline cities are surviving. For many, much of their life has moved into basements.
Most people would rely on flashlights or candles for light and like beds made out of pallets.
I'm Carolyn Beeler. It was a summer of frustrating air travel. In Spain, they're sorting through thousands of unclaimed bags and finding good stuff.
Botas de esquiar, planchas del pelo, secadores.
Ski boots, curling irons, and hair dryers. Now Spaniards can buy those unclaimed items. Those stories and more ahead on The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler in for Marco Werman. You're listening to The World. We start today in New York, where global leaders are gathered for the United Nations General Assembly. Pakistan's Prime Minister Mohammad Shahbaz Sharif took the podium this afternoon. He spoke about the massive floods that have killed roughly 1,600 people in his country this monsoon season.
Why are my people paying the price of such high global warming through no fault of ours? We have no contribution in this.
Sharif said it's time for countries that emit a lot of greenhouse gases, pollution that fuels climate change and made these floods worse, to step up and pay for the impacts.
The dual cost of global inaction and climate injustice are having a crippling effect on both our treasury and our people right here, right now.
Many other leaders have also used their allotted 15 minutes at the lectern to talk about climate change, and they've united around a specific call that richer countries need to start paying developing countries for damages caused by climate change, things like storms and droughts and heat waves. The idea is called loss and damage funding. Barbados Prime Minister Mia Motley argued that it's essential to keep global cooperation on climate change moving forward.
And I ask us today to recognize that those commitments on loss and damage are absolutely critical if we are to make serious progress in saving our world.
Earlier this week, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres spoke on the same point.
It's right time to move beyond endless discussions. Vulnerable countries need meaningful action. Loss and damage are happening now.
Guterres even identified a funding source to help.
Today, I'm calling on all developed economies to tax the windfall profits of fossil fuel companies.
Mackay Robertson, who's a climate negotiator representing the Alliance of Small Island States, says this is the most attention he's ever seen the issue get.
This has been a complete game changer. It is a collective voice saying that there is a massive gap.
There was some advancement on the issue this week. Denmark became the first UN member country to pledge funds, $13 million.
I really appreciate at least the effort that Denmark is making to come up with something tangible, right? And so I think it is a good first step, but we do need to see more from others as well.
The U.S. and many European countries have historically opposed calls for loss and damage funding. And based on remarks U.S. climate envoy John Kerry made this week, it doesn't look like Washington is changing its tune. He said there are more urgent priorities right now.
If we don't lower our emissions, we're croaked. Absolutely croaked. And if we don't adapt starting now, the things that we can adapt to, a whole bunch of people are going to be hurt. So I want to mitigate.
And spend money, he says, on building resilience and the technology to save the planet, not to fixing damage already done. There's more fighting and bloodshed in northern Ethiopia today. A hospital there is saying that a 60-year-old cattle herder was killed by a drone strike. There have been at least 5 airstrikes in the past month since Tigrayan forces and the national government broke a ceasefire. The 2-year conflict has killed thousands of people and displaced millions. For the latest, we turn to William Davison. He's a senior analyst on Ethiopia with the International Crisis Group and joins us from London. William, can you just remind us where this conflict stands today, who's fighting, and over what?
The fighting is between, on the one side, the forces of the Tigray regional government in Ethiopia. The sort of primary dispute was with the Ethiopian federal government. Generally, fighting alongside the federal military has been Amhara regional forces, another Ethiopian region, and also the army of Eritrea, the neighboring nation state. But essentially, Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed took power in 2018. Tigray's rulers, who were also powerful at the federal level, lost out during the transition after Abiy took power. And then they had a constitutional dispute when elections were delayed for COVID-19 in 2020. And that led to the outbreak of war in November 2020.
What do we know about today's airstrike in Tigray and who's responsible?
This is the latest in a series of drone strikes on Tigray's capital, Mekele. It seems likely that the Ethiopian Air Forces has some idea of targeting military installations or perhaps the Tigray leadership. The reports from the ground from the Tigray authorities and hospital have consistently been that these drone strikes have been hitting civilian areas and killing civilians.
Also this week, a new UN report provides details on possible war crimes in Ethiopia. Some findings that stuck out to me were that starvation and rape are being used on a massive scale as weapons of war. What stood out to you in that report?
That's important corroboration of the allegations and suspicions that the federal government, its allies, have been essentially implementing a siege strategy to try and subjugate Tigray and bring this sort of essentially dissident region to heel.
How bad is the humanitarian situation in northern Ethiopia right now?
Very bad. Really, it's a cumulative effect on Tigray, a population of around 6-7 million people. We don't really know the full extent of the suffering. We hear reports of massively increased malnutrition rates and people dying from starvation-related illnesses, and it's already a devastating situation even before this latest round of fighting, which began on 24th of August. And since then, whatever trickle of aid that was going in, either through air medical supplies or by land food aid, those operations have been suspended since the conflict resumed.
Can you remind us why this five-month truce that was holding for a while, why did it fall apart?
For a number of reasons. I mean, essentially, nothing was done to address the political disagreements that led to the war in the first place. So it was always tenuous in that sense. It was also hugely volatile on the ground. The two main parties, the federal and Tigray governments, tried to get a peace process going this year, but maybe without any real sincere commitment to making the concessions needed to start trying to find a negotiated settlement.
So what will it take for all the sides in this conflict to come back to the negotiating table and eventually restore peace to the region?
Well, it requires obviously a shift in attitude. I think the international mediators, the US, the African Union, the UN, the EU, and they need to keep imploring the parties to stop the fighting and at least agree to some form of truce and then readdress this issue of telecommunications, banking and electricity services, which are being denied to Tigray currently. Then maybe that could be a building block to advancing the peace process. But the fact of the matter is, we've kind of gone back to square one over the last month, and there is just a lot more momentum towards continued conflict than there is to revitalizing that peace process currently.
William Davison is a senior analyst on Ethiopia with the International Crisis Group. He joined us from London. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
On Sunday, Cubans will go to the polls to vote in a referendum on a new family code. A yes vote would open the door for same-sex couples to get married and adopt children. As the world's Tibisa Isaiah reports, unlike past elections in Cuba, the outcome for Sunday's vote is anything but clear.
Back in the 1960s and 70s, gay and trans people in Cuba could be arrested and sent to labor camps. Times have changed, though. Now, discrimination based on sexual orientation and gender identity is illegal in Cuba. In fact, it's unconstitutional.
This is definitely a positive development, but it takes more than rights on paper to achieve equality in Cuba.
Cristian Gonzalez is with Human Rights Watch. He says gay, trans, and non-binary people in Cuba continue to suffer from discrimination and violence. In 2019, activists wanted to include same-sex marriage in the revised constitution of Cuba, but they didn't succeed.
There was a backlash from conservative parts of Cuban society, and the authorities unfortunately caved to that pressure and withdrew that provision.
In July, the Cuban Congress moved to rectify that. It came up with a new draft of the National Family Code that would allow same-sex couples the right to marry and adopt. The proposal was celebrated by many Cubans, including Fidel Castro's niece, Mariela Castro. She's a longtime activist on behalf of the LGBTQ community and the director of the Cuban National Center for Sex Education.
Este es un momento realmente muy emocionante.
In an official announcement, Castro said, "This is a very exciting moment for all of the Cuban people committed to the revolution." Mariela Castro went on to say that she's convinced the majority of voters will say yes on Sunday. But not everyone is so enthusiastic. Héctor Valdez is an LGBTQ activist from Cuba. He says fundamental human rights should not be put to a referendum. They should be guaranteed by the state. Valdez says he was expelled from Cuba 7 months ago for his political views. He says that police officers and state security agents used to say offensive things to him because he's gay. Valdez says that he doubts this referendum comes from a legitimate desire of the Cuban government to help LGBTQ people. The Cuban government is trying to whitewash its past mistreatment of the LGBTQ community, he says, and pretend it's a democratic country. Cristian Gonzalez, the researcher with Human Rights Watch, says the government is also trying to avoid direct confrontation with conservative groups, including the church.
So by putting the issue to a referendum, they're not undertaking their responsibility, but they're saying, okay, we're going to allow for the population to decide.
The relationship between the Catholic Church and the state in Cuba has improved a lot since the early days of the Cuban Revolution, when many priests were kicked out of the country. But the church does not have the kind of power and influence it once did, according to Jorge Duany. He's a Cuban anthropologist and the director of the Cuban Research Institute at Florida International University.
The Catholic Church cannot teach in private schools, and it doesn't have any access to the media because all media are owned and controlled by the government.
He says same-sex marriage in Cuba has become a symbol of power balance between the state and the church. But what Duany finds most interesting about this referendum is that for the first time since 1959, Cuba is set to hold an election where the outcome is not known in advance.
And that's unheard of in Cuba. I mean, every election was won by a huge majority of the margins. Nobody's expecting that kind of near unanimous vote this time around.
If the new family code is approved by voters on Sunday, Cuba will become the 8th country in Latin America to legalize same-sex marriage. For the world, I am Tibisa Isea.
And now it's a September smackdown. In one corner, American foreign policy, and the other, professional golf. Okay, that's enough of that. This week, Australian golf legend Greg Norman met with Republican lawmakers on Capitol Hill. His goal? To get support for LIV Golf. It's a Saudi-backed pro golf league that's lured some of the best players in the world away from the PGA Tour. It's funded by Saudi Arabia's Sovereign Wealth Fund, a way to put a friendly face on the kingdom. Former President Trump is a fan. He'd hosted LIV tournaments at his country clubs. But Norman's meeting with GOP lawmakers did not go well. Chip Roy, a congressman from Texas, said, quote, "Don't come in here and act like you're doing some great thing while you're pimping $1 billion of Saudi Arabian money." Ouch. You're listening to The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. This is The World. Thousands of people across Asia are being lured to Cambodia and into forced labor. That's according to a recent report from ProPublica. When they get there, they're forced to trick people across the globe into investing in cryptocurrency scams. Joining me now to explain what's going on is Matt Friedman. He's the founder and CEO of the Mekong Club, an organization that leads anti-slavery efforts in Asia. Matt, this scam is bonkers. Let's take it bit by bit. First, how does a person in Asia hear about these quote-unquote job opportunities that are really fake in a place like Cambodia?
Well, there's a lot of social networking websites that offer advertisements for different types of jobs. And so they see these advertisements. And the advertisements would say, if you want to make somewhere between $3,000 and $5,000 a month working in a casino, living in a very nice hotel and having a great life, contact us and we will send you a ticket and then we will get you to Cambodia and then we'll sign you up and you'll have a great life. So they offer a promise that sounds too good to be true, which is too good to be true.
And who is actually being lured into Cambodia to do this? Who's being targeted by these traffickers?
People, middle class, kind of educated people from Hong Kong, Taiwan, mainland China, Singapore, Malaysia, all over Asia. They are usually looking for people who have computer skills, because if you're going to scam, you need to know something about, you know, how to use a computer. You need to know something about cryptocurrency and various other things. But a lot of these people are just regular people that you would see at a university or at a school, and they're totally unprepared for what's going to happen to them. And it's not just Cambodia, it's Myanmar too. As pressure from governments to close this situation down is building, it's mutating and changing to Myanmar and various other countries as well.
And so once people are lured to Cambodia and then are forced to do this scamming, who are they actually scamming and how do those scams work?
Well, generally, people who are tricked from Hong Kong are scamming people from Hong Kong, Taiwan, scamming people from Taiwan because they know the culture and so forth. Obviously, language is a big part of this. You can't scam people if you don't have the language. But many people in this part of the world also speak English. So we're hearing that people are being scammed in Canada, the UK, the United States, Australia, various other locations around the world. So these facilities have literally hundreds and hundreds of people in there. The people that the scammers are tricking out of money would be just regular people. They would say, I have this great investment opportunity. You're going to make all kinds of money. And here is the website that you can look at to see what the returns are and so forth. All you have to do is kind of agree to using some of your cryptocurrency or making some type of an investment in this.
Victims of these scams often lose thousands of dollars, I gather. Do they have any recourse or ability to get that money back?
If a person is scammed, there is no way of getting that money back. It's on them. And I was just presenting to a bank and I had a conversation about scams. And one of the bankers said, it's almost like if you're a doctor telling somebody that their family member is going to die, you know, it's a hard conversation. As a banker, I have to go to people who have been scammed and say, you lost $500,000. You lost your entire savings and there's nothing we can do about it because there's no insurance or there's no coverage for that type of thing. You made a decision. You gave the money to somebody else and it's gone forever.
Is there anything that, say, Cambodia or any other country where this scamming is happening can do to crack down on these scammers, to stop this activity?
Well, what's happening is there's a lot of pressure from families in Hong Kong, Taiwan, China, all across Asia, to have their governments put pressure on Cambodia. And Cambodia is basically cracking down on these sites. But what's happening is immediately when a site is raided, then they'll move to another site. And so the criminals are getting a lot more sophisticated in terms of finding ways of covering up where they are and what they're doing. And that's part of the problem.
So can you give us some news we can use here? How can people avoid falling into the scams that these scammers are being forced to perform?
You know, if something sounds too good to be true, it probably is. And when it comes to kind of opportunities overseas, chances are, if something sounds so lucrative, it really isn't. So I think what's most important is to raise awareness and to kind of sensitize people to the fact that, you know, if you are being offered a job that with a tremendous amount of money, with very little that you have to do other than to just show up, that's probably not a good thing. And you shouldn't do that. And I think what's happening in social networking now is that this story is getting out to a lot of people. And so as a result of that, the scammers have to go to other locations to try to find ways of tricking and deceiving people into this situation. In some cases, they've actually just grabbed people off the street, put them in the van, driven them to the center, and that's how they get people as well.
You mentioned these scam centers or scam facilities. People have their passports taken away. They can be beaten if they're not meeting the quotas that are set. Can you tell me a little bit more about these centers, the conditions there?
It's like a big apartment building. It has a compound with a 10-foot wall with barbed wire all around it, closed-circuit television, security people. You are literally locked within that facility, and then you are literally kind of kept within the rooms that you are scamming in the room that you sleep in. And your sole purpose is to get in front of a computer and make money for that facility. If you don't, terrible things happen. In some cases, if there's a lot of pressure for a particular individual, they'll sell that person back to the family. And we've heard costs up somewhere between $20,000 and $30,000 to get a family member back. We've also heard of beatings that have resulted in people dying, suicides, people trying to escape, and they're killed. And what they do is they film those things, and then they go back to the people who are in the scam center and show them and say, if you try to leave, this will happen to you as well.
So for the people that have been trafficked and are being held in these prisons, basically, is there any hope for them? I mean, is there any possibility that they might be freed?
Well, we're seeing raids and rescues taking place in Cambodia. We've seen probably a couple of hundred people that have been rescued and sent back. But as I said, what is happening is these people are being transferred to other facilities. I think ultimately the only way this is going to go away is if the government of Cambodia really steps up, does everything they can in order to identify where these centers are, and they shut them down. And they shut them down so that they don't come back someplace else. And this also has to be something that all across Asia, where we see these things popping up, that attempts are made to shut those down as well. This is a very concerning trend. We've never seen anything like this. And one of the things that I just want to mention is that the people who have been trafficked, who have gotten out, said, if I was trafficked to do digging ditches and so forth, that's bad enough. But to scam people from my own country, it adds insult to injury in a sense, because they just feel so bad about what they're doing. It's a horrific situation to be forced to scam fellow citizens from your own country.
That was Matt Friedman, head of the Mekong Club, which tackles human trafficking and cyber scamming across Asia. Thanks for joining us, Matt.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Coming up later in the show, the stories of people who stood up to the Nazis, risking their lives to save Jews during the Holocaust.
They said, we didn't do anything extraordinary. We did what everyone should have done. These people were going to lose their lives for no reason.
Now, the stories of these rescuers is front and center in a new art exhibit. You're listening to The World. Australia's current parliament is considered its most diverse ever. More women, people of color, and the first senator to wear a hijab. An inspiration for Muslim girls across Australia.
They would tell me, now having you in the spotlight, it's almost that sense of pride for them to be able to wear their scarf with that sense of freedom.
Her story is ahead on The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler, in for Marco Werman. You're with The World, a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. The polls opened today in four Russian-occupied areas of Ukraine. People in Luhansk, Donetsk, Kherson, and Zaporizhia are being told to vote yes or no on this question. Should these places become part of Russia? This morning in Kherson, the southern port city, the weather was sunny but chilly. In this video posted on a pro-Russian Twitter account, folks are lined up outside a polling station wearing sweaters and jackets. Some are carrying little Russian flags. One voter was in tears as she told a reporter about her hopes for annexation. Everything will be fine, she says. There will be jobs for our young people. That's the sort of thing the Kremlin wants to hear as it orchestrates these so-called referendums that will run for the next 4 days. The Ukrainian government and its Western allies say this is all a sham, and there's good reason for skepticism. Ukrainian officials say people in Russian-controlled areas are facing threats and intimidation. In this video being circulated widely today, armed soldiers enter an apartment building and knock loudly on doors. Numerous reports say that people are being forced by soldiers to complete ballots. The outcome is virtually assured. The Kremlin is expected to say that residents in these areas of Ukraine support Russian annexation. The turf war in eastern Ukraine is being played out in Avdiivka. It's an industrial city in Ukraine's eastern Donbas region. It's also something of a ghost town. Most of its residents have fled. Many who remain live in basements. Ukrainian fighters have dug in around Avdiivka, using trenches reminiscent of World War I. But Russian soldiers are intent on capturing the strategic town because it stands in the way of their conquering all of the Donbas. The most important building in town for Ukrainian-American pastor Alex Zaitsev is his church, He says it's shot at daily. Pastor Zaitsev spoke with my colleague Marco Werman this week from Mirnograd, about 30 miles west of Avdiivka.
It can be pretty scary sometimes where, you know, you'd see like flares going off or explosions happening close by. But we try to go there during the safest time of the day, which is about noon to early afternoon.
An estimated 3,000 civilians are still in Avdiivka. How do they survive?
Most of the market was destroyed, but kind of on the outskirts, there still are places to sell food. But there's definitely not enough for everybody, and they don't have enough money to buy it anyway. So people would rely on humanitarian aid for food or hygienic items. People gather firewood around the city and cook food outdoors on wood fires. So most of the people would be spending the night in basements since it would be safer there.
Right. I mean, what is life like in a basement in Avdiivka?
Most people would rely on flashlights or candles for light and like beds made out of pallets. But it's pretty crowded often and pretty dank and smelly sometimes.
So some residents of Avdiivka support Ukrainian troops and others support Russian troops. Is that right?
Yes.
And are those two groups openly hostile to one another? What do you see?
The ones that support Ukraine, they're very outspoken. They're saying we're hoping for Ukraine to win. Those that support Russia, they try to stay more quiet. They try not to speak out too much because they're afraid of problems for themselves. But, you know, when you get to understand people, you get to understand that, yeah, these people, you know, they support Russia. And, you know, you go down to their basement to deliver food to some grandma and you see the TV, Russian news showing on the TV. You're like, well, okay, that makes sense. So they support Russia.
So speaking of getting information, do most people in Avdiivka know that in four nearby Russian-controlled regions, local leaders are planning to hold referendums on joining Russia? Is that commonly known?
Yes. Some people are saying, well, we believe that after the referendum, things will get better there. I'm saying, well, you guys already went to a referendum before. Did it get better? It didn't. Those that support Ukrainian military, they're saying, you know, who cares about a referendum? It's not going to change anything. So after the liberation of the Kharkiv area, pro-Ukrainian people are a lot more hopeful for a quick and good end to this war.
So Avdiivka is very close to the Russian border, regardless of support for one side or the other. Do most residents there listen to Russian radio and TV stations?
They do, yes. There's a lot of effort and money going into make Russian channels and Russian radio as clear as possible in Avdiivka. So whenever I drive in there, I've even experimented. I cannot catch a single Ukrainian radio station, only Russian radio station. And I've heard things such as, you know, a song in Russian ends, and suddenly it's saying, you know, people of, you know, this and that city, you do understand that it's the Ukrainian army that's shooting at you. You need to, you know, call this phone number and report these people, report the positions of Ukrainian military or various things like that you can hear. And I'm sure that many people are gullible enough to call in and report that, yeah, I've seen Ukrainian military here or I've seen Ukrainian military there. Just recently here in Mirnograd, we had a rocket fall in a school where military was just beginning to move in. And they caught the woman that called in to one of these numbers and said, yeah, the Ukrainian military in this school, they're moving in, you know, tech and weapons. And that very evening, a rocket hit that same school. So people that support Russia are doing that.
Ukrainian-American pastor Alex Zaitsev is helping evacuate civilians from the eastern Ukrainian city of Avdiivka and providing basic necessities for those who stay. He spoke with Marco Werman. Australia's current parliament is being called the most diverse ever. It has a record number of women, Asian, and Indigenous lawmakers. Fatima Payman is also making history. She is the senator representing Western Australia and is the first member of parliament to wear a hijab. The World's Bianca Hillier reports on the senator's journey to Australia's capital, Canberra.
Senator Payman says Australia has always felt like home. But for the first few years of her life, it wasn't. She shared her story in a recent speech in Parliament.
On a cold winter evening, 8,852 kilometres away from Perth, I was born in Kabul, Afghanistan, in 1995.
Her parents' joy of welcoming their first child soon faded, though, as Afghanistan fell to the Taliban within a year.
With no hope in sight, my parents had to make the tough decision of fleeing to Pakistan with my newborn sister and I.
When I spoke with Payman on the phone this week, she told me Pakistan was always a temporary home. It wasn't long before her dad left South Asia by boat for Australia. He landed in Perth and worked as a kitchen hand, a security guard, and a taxi driver to save enough money to bring over the rest of his family.
We would talk to Dad on the phone. We'd have photos of Dad around.
They didn't see each other for 4 years. Then they finally got the call. It was time to pack up and join Dad in Western Australia.
There was this incredible sense of joy flying here and seeing Dad after so long.
Payman says she quickly felt at home at the Muslim school she attended in Perth.
People looked similar to me and we prayed our midday prayers together.
Then, around the age 11 or 12, she decided to start wearing a hijab.
As a young kid, I was like, yep, it's part of my attire. It's part of my identity. This is who I am and I really want to wear it. And I never felt out of place until, I guess, post certain events happening around the world.
9/11 had given rise to Islamophobia across the globe. And then,
Australian police surround a cafe in the centre of Sydney where a gunman is holding staff and customers hostage.
In 2014, two hostages were killed in the Lindt Cafe shooting.
There are clear signs that Islamic extremism motivated his actions.
Authorities fear that the Sydney siege is the type of lone wolf terrorist attack that has long been anticipated.
This Islamophobic rhetoric was on the rise and people would start throwing comments like, go back to where you came from, or towelhead, or at university, somebody even asked, if I had a bomb under that thing on my head.
In those moments, Payman says she leaned on her dad's tried and true advice.
My dad instilled in me the values of perseverance and always being confident in myself and not letting any man intimidate me.
Living by those values is a big reason why, at just 27 years old, Senator Payman is the first hijabi in the Australian Parliament. She's also the first Afghan Australian to be elected and represents the Labour Party. It's a result she doesn't think would have been possible just 10 years ago. Candidly, Senator Payman says the pressure is immense.
In terms of like what I say, what I do, where I'm seen.
Still, she says it's important to acknowledge that her win is a milestone for Australia.
There are other Muslim girls that have reached out to me or have spoken to me. And they would tell me, now having you in the spotlight, it's almost that sense of pride for them to be able to wear their scarf with that sense of freedom.
Payman says she's proud to have made that difference. In a speech earlier this summer, she said she hasn't done it alone.
I'd like my first gratitude to be expressed to my late beloved father, whose sacrifices will never be forgotten, and who I dearly wish he was here to see how far his little daughter's come.
Mm-hmm. Senator Payman's dad, who had been her lifelong role model and introduced her to the Labour Party as a kid, died of cancer in 2018. He was just 47 years old.
Despite this, my father was still the strongest man I have ever known. He may have passed on, but his memories and teachings will forever remain.
Senator Payman told me she's driven to contribute to his legacy and make the most of his sacrifices.
Who would have thought that a girl who found herself in the war-torn country of Afghanistan, whose dad risked his life traveling the ocean for a safe place, is now a senator of that same land? Like, it gives me goosebumps just thinking about the odds. It almost feels like it's from a movie or something.
To Senator Payman, the perfect ending to the movie would be for her story to not be an anomaly. She plans to use her position of power to break down barriers for marginalized Australians so they can join her in government and raise issues that matter to them. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
If you took a flight this summer, there's a decent chance you've got a travel nightmare story or two to share, and it may be about lost luggage. Last summer saw a huge spike in misplaced bags. In Spain alone, some 20,000 suitcases are still sitting in airport warehouses. But a nonprofit there has found a way to give the unclaimed bags and their contents another life. Reporter Jerry Haddon explains from El Prat near Barcelona.
On a recent morning, a luggage handler wheels a dolly teetering with suitcases down a crowded hall. He's not headed for the airport baggage carousels. In fact, we're about 2 miles from Barcelona's airport, in a shopping mall. The handler stops at a small store called Envera. Manager Jonathan Romero signs for the bags, bags long unclaimed by their owners.
Es un espacio donde recibimos todos aquellos objetos.
This is a space where we take in all the lost objects found in airports and on airplanes, he says, noting the new inventory in his ledger. Anything that gets lost and is not claimed, he says, we take and open and sort, sterilize, price, then sell.
Todo aquel producto que es nuevo o seminuevo.
Anything we find that's new or nearly new, he says, we donate secondhand clothes. Then there's other stuff, he says, giving me a tour. There are scuba suits and gear, he says, ski boots, curling irons, and hair dryers. Perusing these shelves feels a bit like rummaging through someone else's private stuff, because that's pretty much what you're doing. There are shelves of other people's sunglasses, their cheap souvenirs and fridge magnets, their flip-flops, hats, books, bikinis. Envera's a nonprofit. Proceeds here create jobs for people with mental and physical challenges, like saleswoman Manoli Martin. She has a badly herniated disc and had to give up mainstream work. We're going to open one of the newly arrived suitcases, she says with a smile. Let's see what surprises we find inside. Martin unzips the little carry-on imprinted with a Big Ben photo on the outside. On the inside, it's packed. Martin pulls out a fake plastic license plate from Granada, a souvenir bowl from Thailand, one of those stretchy rubber exercise bands, stuff she says that she'll sell quickly and for cheap. The mint-conditioned suitcase itself, $15. But this week's oddest item, Martin says, walking about the store, is this self-massaging mat. She opens the box. It's basically a yoga mat covered in tiny, blunted nails. You lie on it, and somehow that's supposed to be pleasant. Envera is tiny, but we're right across the aisle from a giant Carrefour supermarket. As customers pay for food, they're looking right at us. Ana Treciera and her husband pop over. She rummages through Envera's kids section while he waits by the grocery cart. I was just looking for toys and other things, Treciera says. Today I'm buying this wooden choo-choo train for our two-year-old. The price, €2. Most everything here is marked down at least 70%. We bought lots of stuff here, Treciera says. Shoes, toys, a bit of everything. She says, I think we pick up something every time we come grocery shopping. Treciera pays for the train. Somewhere there might just be another toddler who had a good cry when that same choo-choo went into a plane and never came out. But one kid's loss is another's gain. It's a circular system, manager Romero says. We give second life to these items so that we don't need to keep manufacturing more. But make no mistake, Romero says, this is not a secondhand store. In a secondhand store, you buy stuff people didn't want. Here, he says, we sell things that people did want but lost. There's a huge difference. There may be an element of tragedy to it all, but Romero says the lost belongings are of the highest quality and the proceeds for a good cause. Every once in a while, Envera workers open a suitcase and find some kind of ID. In those cases, they contact the owner. Once, says Romero, it was a pretty famous guy. The first clue was a trophy inside the suitcase, the Golden Cleat, pro indoor soccer's highest award.
Ricardinho, si no recuerdo mal, la bota de oro.
I think the owner's name was Ricardinho, he says. It was his trophy, which he'd clearly lost, but we found. Ricardinho is considered the best pro indoor soccer player in history. He came down to Envera to get his golden cleat back. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon, El Prat, Spain.
30 years ago, a photographer and a writer captured the stories of more than 100 Europeans who risked their lives to save Jews during the Holocaust. A photo exhibit called Rescuers of the Holocaust came out of it. It featured portraits of the rescuers and a film with interviews of them. 3 decades later, the exhibition is back for another look, this time at the Jack Fisher Gallery in San Francisco. And as the world's Sarah Birnbaum reports, the work is just as relevant today.
Since the Holocaust, there's been a lot written about the bystanders and perpetrators. Around the same time that philosopher Hannah Arendt was covering the trial of SS officer Adolf Eichmann and writing about the banality of evil, Yale psychologist Stanley Milgram was conducting experiments based on this question.
How is it possible, I ask myself, that ordinary people who are courteous and decent in everyday life can act callously, inhumanely, without any limitations of conscience?
Then there are all the books, articles, and films that try to understand the bystanders. People like this Hungarian priest, who described in a documentary how he watched the SS load Jews into cattle cars, and then he ran away.
Jewish people were deported around me. I didn't do anything. I panicked. Not even panic, not even fear. I just didn't know what to do.
But this project, Rescuers, isn't about that. It's about people like Arnold Daus, a Dutch gardener who did know what to do.
When you see an injustice done, you do something against it. When you see people being persecuted, you have to help them.
That was a clip from the film in the exhibition. Daus built and maintained a network of families willing to hide Jews. Thanks in part to him, nearly every family in his town hid someone. Daus's photo hangs in the exhibition. It's one of 28 portraits of people who hid, protected, and saved Jews during World War II. When the photographer Gay Block started this project in 1987, she wanted to know what kind of people would put their lives on the line to save someone else. Block says the answers were as varied as the rescuers themselves.
People just did it for so many different reasons. Some had never met a Jew and realized what was going on was just wrong. Some had Jewish friends and said, we can't let this happen to our friends.
Maria Countess von Maltzahn from Germany told Block it was easy for her to resist Nazi authority because she had always resisted her mother's authority.
Because my mother was unjust, I of course got a very high feeling of justice.
She says there, because my mother was unjust, I had a very high feeling of injustice. The portrait of the countess that hangs in the exhibition shows a woman holding a cigarette and staring straight at you. During the war in Berlin, Countess von Maltzahn hid Jews in a secret compartment in her sofa. One time, the Gestapo was ransacking her apartment. She decided to irritate them by throwing a ball to her 2 dogs for hours. The Nazi police demanded that she open up her sofa bed, which would mean that they would have found her Jewish lover Hans hiding inside. So she told them the sofa was stuck and said they could shoot at it with their guns if they'd like, but then they'd have to pay the upholstery bill. They left. She married Hans after the war. In the interview for the Rescuers Project, writer Malka Drucker asked Countess von Maltzahn if she was scared.
Did you ever have any doubts at times? Because your life has obviously been so much harder.
Of course, you get into a very tough situation, but I don't care. I mean, I prefer to be in a tough situation and to go to bed with a bad conscience.
She says she prefers to be in a tough situation than go to bed with a bad conscience. She brushed aside her bravery. That's something all the rescuers did, says Block.
They said we didn't do anything extraordinary. We did what everyone should have done. These people were going to lose their lives for no reason.
They didn't feel particularly heroic.
The word hero is totally misplaced. It's a terrible word for us.
This is Jotja Voss. She and her husband hid 3 dozen Jews in their home near Amsterdam. She said they didn't just say from the get-go, okay, now we're going to risk our lives to save some people.
How it happened is that somebody asked us, listen, I have a little suitcase with some valuables and I have to go to the ghetto where you keep that suitcase for me. So then you said, well, of course I keep that suitcase for you. And then a week later, somebody would ask you, well, my child is in danger. Well, we said, of course, bring it here. So that's not heroic. That's just doing what your heart tells you at the moment to do.
In the Rescuers exhibit, Bloch's portraits resist heroic clichés. For example, the prints are in color, which is a decision Block made partway through the project. She says she didn't want the drama of black and white.
What I want the images to express is the ordinariness of the people. If these people could do this, anyone could. And so it was just to show the face of these people who were not extraordinary people in terms of what they looked like. It was just extraordinary that they were able to take that risk.
When Hannah Arendt wrote about the banality of evil, she was talking about how, given certain circumstances, ordinary people can do heinous things. This exhibition suggests the flip side, the banality of heroism, that given the right conditions, ordinary people can do brave, virtuous, remarkable things. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
On Sunday night, Jewish people around the globe will celebrate the New Year, Rosh Hashanah, a moment to reset, to taste the sweetness of life, and a time for introspection. This kind of communal renewal is, of course, not unique to Judaism. This is a jam from Ghana that has that same kind of vibe.
Wale, 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 wale.
That's singer-songwriter, guitarist, and band leader Okaja Afroso with a song he composed called Wole Wohe. He's from Ghana's coastal village of Kakrabiti. His song is a call to action of sorts for the people of the region. With eyes wide open, he sings, spirit awakened with determination, people join hands. Together, we redefine our past, present, and future. We leave you with that new music from Ghana's Okaja Afroso and his international ensemble of musicians. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. Online, we're at theworld.org. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Have a great weekend, and we'll be back with you here when Monday rolls around again.
Chuchuko, chuchuko, chuchu ama mehiewa, nana papani, nana kanswa, nana shishu, nana dada uwenchenye, nishokenku, nishoken, nishokenku kemba, nishokenku.